As the morning advanced, the speed of the exchanges began to increase. The rest of the goods came out swiftly, were repacked, and one after another rowed out to the waiting vessels, where the crews loaded them aboard as more and more payments went into the waiting container. Before the sun had reached its zenith, the smaller of the ships were leaving, the Macassan fishermen singing as they put their backs into their rowing and loading the dugout canoes back onto the prows. Their small white sails went up as they drove past the sea serpents and vanished into clouds upon the ocean, sculling away. As the other containers were emptied of their deliveries, many of the goods which had been left and unloaded over the past week were now transferred within, in their place. The heaps of trepang now dried and smoked, the sweetly fragrant ripe fruit each bundled separate into a little wrapping of paper.
"They mean to ship fruit?"
Lawrence said doubtfully. He had come to watch. Temeraire inquired of one of the officials, who had come hurrying inside for a fresh pot of ink.
"Yes," the young man said. "The deep water keeps it cold, and only half of it will spoil. Of course it is all for the Imperial Court. 6 silver, he added, when Temeraire asked the cost of a piece.
"Good God," Lawrence said, comprehensively,
and Temeraire had to feel that for his own part he should have rather had 6 silver coins than 1 piece of fruit, which might as easily be spoilt as not, and in any case would not even make a bite.
"But,"
he said wistfully, thinking of the great treasure chambers at the Emperor's court, which his mother had shown him on their visit,
"perhaps if one has so very many silver coins that one cannot look at them all and enjoy them, one might rather have a piece of fruit, and then one might eat it and think, that is the taste of 6 silver coins.
One entire container, one of the newest, judging by the colour of the outer wood, not yet as stained by the ocean waters, was thoroughly lined with oilcloth, and into this were laid bundles upon bundles of furs from the American ship. They were not gold or brilliantly coloured, so Temeraire found it a little peculiar that so much care should be taken with them. But when one of the bundles was spread out, it did glow very richly in the sunlight, a sort of warm red-brown colour, and Lawrence evidently thought them very fine. "Beaver," he said, "and seal, and mink, which would go to make winter coats of particular warmth."
"Perhaps I ought to have one made for Granby,"
Iskierka said, showing away, Temeraire thought with some superiority, out of jealousy over Lawrence's robes. It certainly could not compare in beauty, although as a practical matter it might not be a bad notion. But it did not seem as though it was ever cold in this country. Not all the furs were laid into the container, either. Mr. Chuckwa and Signor Robaldo were not allowing anything on the order of a philosophical difference to stand in the way of their making a separate arrangement, and a crate of furs was exchanged for a casket of gold and silver to the satisfaction of both parties. At the very last, a final few containers were opened, and within them, inside oilskin wrappings, a second nested container, and within that another layer of oilskin, which folded back, revealed at last rows upon rows of sealed wooden casks, marked with characters upon the top. Silver needle, white dragon, yellow flower, and when one of these was breached, the lovely, fragrant smell of tea wafted nearly to the pavilion.
"How many tons would you say this delivery has made?"
Lawrence said to Tharkey, as the tea was bargained out among the captains for really astonishing amounts of gold, Temeraire wistfully noticed.
20, at the least, Tharkey said, and flicked a hand at the smaller pile of goods set aside at the end of the beach,
those which had not been taken by anyone. Temeraire had been wondering with increasing interest what should be the fate of those neglected goods, as he could not see anything wrong with any of them.
"I imagine the leavings are all they send to Sydney."
"It is ours. It is part of the payment for using Larrakia country," Tharunka explained, looking up. "Whatever they cannot sell, we keep. And whatever we don't want, we trade to the Pichanchachara and the Yongu. And I think the Pichanchachara trade it to the Bakinji, and the Wiradjuri, who take it to Sydney and trade it to you. So everyone may have something they like, and no one has to travel anywhere they don't want, and by the end of it no one gets left with anything they don't care for."
Which seemed to Temeraire an eminently sensible arrangement through and through. Lawrence did not seem quite so sanguine.
"How often do the serpents come with such a load?" he asked.
Tharunka consulted with Binmok, the chief of her companions, a woman with a soft and peculiarly deep voice. With a woman's habit of silent labour, this had encouraged the aviators to think her shy, but she had quite established her authority after Maynard had attempted, with an offering of rum which he had somehow once again filched out of the stores, to wheedle one of the younger women out behind the pavilion. This conversation, which had been carried out in a combination of coaxing whispers and covert pantomime, to evade Lawrence's attention, as he had made quite clear his opinion of such behaviour, went forward for some 10 minutes, with the woman's attitude passing from initially a half-flirtatious fascination to withdrawal, as Maynard tried to put his hand upon her arm and draw her out. Tamara had just been wondering if he ought, perhaps, say something to Lawrence, even though the young women were Tharonka's and not his, but Binmok had silently risen up, taken one of the logs from the fire, and coming over to Maynard, clouted him solidly across the back, with so much force that he was knocked flat to the ground on his face, the rum spilling beneath him. He sprang up red-faced and wet, which Tamara felt served him right. The women all laughed with great enjoyment, pointing at the spreading dark stain upon his shirt. They none of them wore much in the way of clothing, and Maynard slunk hurriedly away in the face of Binmok's unsmiling and censorious expression, and her substantial cudgel. Now she listened thoughtfully to Tharonka's translation of their question, then answered at length.
"This one was particularly good," Tharonka said, "but Binmok says that they have been bringing more and more, as they get more of the serpents trained. The Chinese don't like to put goods on any one of them until it has swum the route back and forth 3 times, without, you see, because it is such a long way. Sometimes a new serpent will change its mind and just go another way, and then all your goods are lost. They come once a month," she added, "because there are 2 schools now trained to come here and return to Guangzhou. When one leaves here, another leaves there, and they go in opposite directions."
"And they may add more, I expect," Lawrence said grimly, "and with no great delay,"
which Temeraire supposed was true. After all, if all one wanted was fish, and one did not mind where one swam, why ought they not swim here, where they should be given so many? The Larrakia had been feeding them all day, whenever they swam up to the bell.
"They won't like it above half in Whitehall, I suppose," Granby said. "How soon do you think they will hear of it? It can't be long."
"No," Lawrence said. "These gentlemen," indicating the ships yet riding at anchor, "are adventurers, following nothing much better than a rumour in hopes of finding a profitable run. But each one of them will make that rumour into news, wherever they put into port, and I cannot imagine no British captain has yet heard those same stories. We have any number of Indiamen running all over these waters and going on to China as well."
Temeré did not see how it should be anything to the British, even so. But Lawrence and Granby and Tharkay all seemed not even to doubt that it should be provoking in the extreme, and that there was only a question when an angry answer should come about it.
"The absence of those tariffs which drive up the price of Chinese goods must wreck the trade in and out of Canton as soon as it reaches a sufficient quantity," Lawrence said, "as also must the lower risk. A serpent cannot be sunk, and if they will from time to time wander afield or lose a container, each single one is not on the scale of a full merchantman." "But that must now be scarcely the worst of the situation," Lawrence added. "There is no smuggler's cove. This is a port city and a growing one, under the auspices of a nation which, if it is not our enemy, is not our ally. A port here upon the very rim of the Indian Ocean must represent a very real strategic threat to the security of our shipping and to British mastery of the seas."
Temeraire privately felt that it seemed a little unreasonable for a country as small as Britain to want to rule an ocean halfway around the world, and to complain if China, which was much larger and nearer anyway, wished to only have some sea serpents coming by with splendid things which people wanted to buy.
"I am sure they would not mind if British merchants should come also," Temeraire suggested.
"They have never objected to taking our silver before," Lawrence said. "But that will only lead to the same complications as before, which our government have already been protesting, and the deficit between our nations will only be increased by a greater flow of goods. They are not likely to take finished goods or anything else which it profits Britain to trade."
"Except opium," Tharkay said, a little sardonic, "which manages its own popularity. The public inspection of the goods might offer some difficulties, but I think one must have faith in the ingenuity of man."
Lawrence was silent. He did not approve of opium, although it was so very useful for managing cattle and sheep, when one wished to carry them along and eat better than whatever one could hunt. Temeraire was rather sorry they had not had some of it with them upon their journey, as they might have taken along some of the cows from their valley.
"Even that trade is not likely to be sufficient consolation in Whitehall," Lawrence said finally, "for the establishment of a port which, at the discretion of the Emperor, might give safe harbour to the French to prey upon our shipping, or at his will lock out British traders and none others from the profits of the trade, whatever those may be."